Thank you, Michael. And just FYI, WBAI is recording this, and that's what this mic is for. All right. Our second speaker is Michael Krinsky of Rabinowitz, Boudin, Standard, Krinsky, and Lieberman, PC, the firm which has been Cuba's only U.S. counsel since September 1960. He's the author, along with David Golub, of U.S. Economic Measures Against Cuba, Proceedings in the United Nations and International Law Issues. Michael will discuss what these new developments mean from a legal perspective and other perspectives, and what lies ahead.
Thank you. It's a little daunting to try to talk about what all this means from a legal perspective. We've been living with this, what the Cubans properly called the blockade, for 55 years. I've been dealing with it for 45 years. And it's going to take more than a few months to dismantle it. When I came to the my law office in 1970, the legal framework for the blockade was really quite different than it is now. It was a president's blockade. The president imposed these measures against Cuba, all these restrictions against trade, against finance, against travel, in the president's own discretion. It was under the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917, and under that act, the president could impose restrictions of this sort and could lift them when he or she chose. In 1996, Congress adopted what's called the Helms-Burton Act. And this was quite a piece of work. Many, many provisions, many titles. And it was enacted really, I think, out of an exaggerated fear that Bill Clinton, was going to really move forward and really start to normalize relations with Cuba. And what the Republicans did, mostly the Republicans, but with substantial Democratic support, was try to put in place legislation that would curtail the power of the president to modify and to lift the embargo. In its broad strokes, it said that the embargo must remain in effect until there is a transitional government in Cuba and then a democratic government in Cuba. And they defined, but this is the joke. They said three things, and 12 things actually, were necessary for there to be a transitional government in Cuba or a democratic government in Cuba. Among those three things, among those 12 things, was first, the government cannot include Fidel or Raul Castro. Second, there had to be a restoration or compensation of the property taken in the nationalizations, including the property of people and companies that were Cuban at the time. Even though international law, including as recognized by the U.S. courts, have said that's not an obligation of international law for a country to take the property of its own citizens. It's a different question when you take the property of foreigners. And the third thing was there had to be a restoration, they called it a restoration, of free market capitalism. This is the law of the United States. So you realize what that means is if the Cuban people were to vote in a certified free election, in which Fidel and Raul Castro were not running. If the Cuban people voted to retain socialism under Helms-Burton, the embargo would remain. So that became a radical shift in the legal structure of the U.S. embargo. Now, then it got more complicated. To make this meaningful and to guard against Clinton and whoever eroding the embargo, Helms and Burton tried to inserted in this legislation a provision which was called the codification provision. And it said that the embargo that was in place in April 1996 would remain in place until we had this democratic, you know, government of free enterprise in Cuba. Now, through negotiations with the White House, perhaps with a little bit of ineptitude, this language was not drafted the way good lawyers would have drafted that language. And so immediately what happened was the Clinton administration, after Clinton signed the legislation, said, well, this codification provision not only codifies the restrictions, but codifies my licensing authority under the embargo regulations. The embargo regulations prohibit things unless they are licensed. They prohibit almost everything unless it is licensed. But this codification provision includes not only the prohibition, but my authority to license. So the Clinton administration took that legal position soon after Helms-Burton was passed. And then Clinton's successor in office, the Bush administration, also took the same position. You had to hunt around for it. But they were jealous enough of presidential authority to take the same position. And Obama took the same position. So within the structure of the Helms-Burton Act, the president still has asserted and still retains the licensing authority. People who are opposed to moving on the Cuba issue have said, well, the president's authority is really very, very curtailed. Barely can only do a little bit. The day before Obama made his announcement on December 17th, I was having a debate in Havana with some fellow from Washington, a lawyer from Washington, who said, the president really can't do much because of Helms-Burton. It's very constrained. And I would say, no, the president can do an immense amount, can license this, can license that, can really open things up. And so I had the pleasure of seeing him the next day after Obama's announcement. And I reminded him of the debate. So what Obama did after his announcement was that on January 15th, he issued a series of amendments to the embargo regulations using his licensing authority. Ironically, through separate legislation, travel to Cuba is constrained, and it's not within the president's licensing authority in the sense that there are 12 categories of permissible travel to Cuba: professional research, family visits, and so on. And Congress in this subsequent legislation, said the president can't go beyond those 12 categories. So what the president did on January 15th was he stayed within those 12 categories, but expanded them almost as far as they could go. to try to increase the flow of travel to Cuba. The most important of those categories, at least in terms of volume of people, is what's called the people-to-people travel, which is you go on a program where you're supposed to go and have exchanges with the Cuban people in some sort of structured way. Obama could have gone further within that category and said, you don't have to go as part of an organized group under someone's or U.S. organization's auspices. You could just go individually and meet the Cuban people yourself. He could have gone that far, but he didn't, which I think was going to be a mistake. But the result of this expansion of the 12 categories is very great. I mean, it's almost impossible to get a hotel room in Havana now. It's impossible to get a seat on an airplane out of Miami now. So Obama moved on the issue of travel. He also, by the way, authorized U.S. airlines to start to run regular scheduled flights. That hasn't happened yet, but it may happen. That will also be a substantial transformation of the situation. In another area, Obama also moved very far. He moved in the area of telecommunications, telephone service, data service. There, he really licensed just about everything, including U.S. companies investing and making contracts to upgrade the Cuban infrastructure. It's the first time that since 1960, that the United States companies have been able to invest in any area of Cuban activity. There are areas you can buy, there's areas you can sell. This is the first area of investment. So, you know, those two things, travel, telecommunications, that was pretty good. That was a pretty good beginning. And then there were a series of amendments, which I think revealed the true hand of the administration, if there was any much questions about it. And it's very much along the lines of what Michael said. What Obama and the other amendments did was open up channels of trade with the emerging private sector in Cuba. U.S. companies can now sell to the private sector in Cuba. U.S. companies can now engage private Cuban individuals for their services. If Google could figure out how to, or Microsoft could figure out how to arrange it, they are now legally able to hire Cuban software engineers and programmers to work for Google while they are in Cuba. U.S. companies are able to buy products produced by the private sector. So all of this is with the private sector. And it's stated very, very, very simply. I mean, I was on a teleconference with the Commerce Department explaining the regulations to lawyers, you think you call in, briefings. And the guy started off and saying, the president's policy is to support the private sector in Cuba. Now, it's a curious moment because, of course, Cuba itself is trying in many ways to develop the private sector. But Cuba does not intend for the state sector, for socialism, to go out of business. And so we have this curious business of the Obama administration, on the one hand, moving the policy in a very, very dramatic ways, and perhaps setting off a dynamic which will be irreversible, which will expand, which will grow deeper perhaps. But at the same time, still pursuing the same goal that was there in 59, and you know, the humans will say it was there in the 19th century, back. And which is to bring an end to socialism in Cuba, and to reestablish U.S. dominance, hegemony, if you will, in Cuba. Now, that's how I see it. I don't think, though, and there are lots of, as lawyers, we can all look at very many interesting little aspects of this regulatory change. But that's the basic framework, and that's the basic movement and where we are as of today. I think that, and I work on this, on a daily basis, every day. And, I can get a little bit, you can lose the forest for the trees also in another way. We could forget, looking at the changes, we could forget about what the U.S. ultimate intention, in my view, is. We could also, however, forget that in so many ways this is a very hopeful development. It is a very, in my view, triumphant development. When I was in Havana, as I think Sandy was, on the week of when Obama and Raul made their announcements on December 17th, it was striking to me. People at this conference I was at, but also just people on the street, people you would meet, they would go up to each other and they would embrace and they would say congratulations. They would say congratulations to each other. They were congratulating each other. And they were congratulating each other like, we did it. We held on. We held on for all these years and all these decades against this immense onslaught from the United States. And we did it. We brought them to the negotiating table. We brought them to the place where the President of the United States got on the phone with the President of Cuba and said, we want to normalize diplomatic relations. So there was a sense of, and I think rightfully so, a sense of triumph and pride in that. And there was also, and I don't know whether folks share this thing, is I felt this sense of hopefulness in the Cuban people that I met. That we don't know what the future is going to bring. We don't know whether what's going to happen to our country. We don't know what's going to happen to socialism. We don't know any of these things. But we know that we are. But now we have more hope than we had the day before. A lot more hope that this unrelenting crushing embargo blockade from the United States is going to be eased, and very substantial part, we hope, dismantled. And that will give room, and that will give opportunity that I think many people in Cuba had given up hoping for. And so I think, we look at this thing, and I think it's a complicated moment we're in. And that we have to come to a very balanced view, which is going to be hard, between recognizing what the as Ricardo Alarcón says, in the passage quoted by Michael, recognizing that the goal of the United States is the same, but also recognizing that we are at a different moment. And it is a hopeful moment that a lot of people sacrifice a lot for a long time to get us to. So that's That's my perspective, legal and otherwise.